We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. This year, our program, Focus, turned 30, and we have been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting and, in some cases, most controversial guests and touch on topics that we think are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. In this installment of what we are calling the Deep Archives Project, we have two interviews that explore physician-assisted suicide. Surveys have shown that when you ask people about the end of life, their big fear isn't death, it is meaningless suffering. What people seem to want is some measure of control. And although no one knows how often it happens, there are physicians who have been willing to help. In June of 1990, Dr. Jack Kevorkian made headlines when he helped a 50-year-old Michigan woman named Janet Adkins, suffering with Alzheimer's disease, to die. It was the first publicly acknowledged physician-assisted suicide. Dr. Kevorkian had another name for it. He called it medicide. He was charged with murder, although the charges were later dropped. He became so closely identified with assisted suicide, the media began to call him Dr. Death. In the fall of 1991, we talked about a book that he had written, Prescription Medicide, The Goodness of Planned Death, and I asked Jack Kevorkian why it was he had taken up this cause.
Well, as a physician, as a trainee in medicine, every medical person has seen cases where he knows or she knows deep down this person has a legitimate request in wanting your life ended. Everyone's seen that, or else they haven't had adequate medical training or experience. And using a free mind without encumbrances or straitjackets of any kind of philosophy, I look at what is in front of me as a problem, and then using reason, common sense, and medical knowledge, try to come to a decision based on what the problem is, not based on some ancient dictum. See, and I knew long ago that euthanasia was a legitimate concept. I knew that in training from the patients I was seeing. And I got into it when I learned about what the Dutch were doing in 1986. I think it was 86. I learned that they were actually performing euthanasia there by injection. And that bit of common sense and rationality really impacted me. I went over there to check into the thing, and then I expanded my thing from the condemned criminals to include any kind of planned death that is justified. And that's how I got into assisted. And then since it was illegal in this country for us to do the injecting as the Dutch do, I devised a way where I could help someone to do it by assisting a suicide, because in Michigan there was no law, and in about 10 or 12 states there is no law against that. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I did it the only legal way available to me. I'm sure if it were legal, I would have done the injecting on some patients. Mm-hmm. Not that I enjoy it, but it would have been sure. But the device does the same thing without my having to do it, so it removes me a little more from ethical vulnerability.
I think that some people, though, would question that. I think that one of your conclusions, and you write about it in the book, that the reason that this device that you invented and this method of assisting suicide is important is because for physicians, it eliminates this ethical problem. And yet, at the same time, I think that many people would say, while it's true that you don't do the injecting, you don't push the button, you, in a sense, are the agent. You have made it possible. You hook the person up to the machine, and that in some places you would be an accessory to murder.
Oh, that's not true. It's not murder by definition in the first place. That word is loosely bandied about. The worst it can be is manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not doing it with malice aforethought and with reckless disregard for life. That's ridiculous. That's the definition of murder. I mean, that's an emotional outburst. It can be manslaughter at worst, according to law today. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in most states in which it is illegal, it is manslaughter. It's not called murder.
Well,
I wish that word would be dropped in discussion from this.
Well, then forgive me for being imprecise in the legal sense. I guess the point that I was trying to make is that that some people would say that you're by using this device, mm-hmm. you're not as far removed as you seem to be saying that you are.
Well, you are. Listen, when a surgeon operates on a patient to help him, help her, and the patient dies accidentally, that's involuntary manslaughter. By definition, it's involuntary. Now, that is a felony, too. How come our physicians aren't imprisoned? You're doing a medical service. Therefore, my making it available for a patient is a medical service. Mm-hmm. But I don't do the injecting, just like a surgeon doesn't purposely do the killing. You see, you pick this one episode and say, now that is vulnerable, that's manslaughter. But the surgeons, when the death is accidental on the table, that's not manslaughter. But they're both the same, they're comparable.
Well, although
each is a physician performing a legitimate medical service, because what I did was widely practiced and ethical in Hippocrates' day. Mm-hmm. Religion made it unethical, but that's a religious decision, not medical.
Well, let me ask you that then. Again, some people will point to the oath that physicians take and that phrase, and perhaps it has been misquoted, that phrase about that you should do no harm. How do you take that into account as you're thinking about
what
your appropriateness?
What harm did I do, Janet Atkins? She wanted it. She craved it, demanded it. What harm did I do? Medically, it was justified. What harm was done? The harm was done in the minds of those critics whose minds are enslaved by certain philosophic principles. Their minds are harmed, not Janet Atkins. The harm is imputed from their mind to Janet Atkins and to me. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, yes, I think I hear what you're saying.
Can you point out the harm that was done here? Janet didn't think it was harmful. The family didn't think it was harmful. Many people didn't think it was harmful. I certainly didn't. Hmm. Where's the harm?
How do one of the criticisms that was made was that you had not known the Atkins family for very long. You didn't know her for a very long time, and that perhaps you being a physician but not being a psychiatrist or trained in therapy would not be in a very good position to evaluate her mental state. Now, I don't know whether you would feel that that was something that you should be called upon to do.
Well, I would do it in every case.
How does one decide whether, in fact, the individual who's making the choice is making a rational choice? Or do you worry that you should have to do that?
Well, you don't worry. That's just common sense. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Now, people who criticize me for that are saying I have no common sense. That's ridiculous.
So
Janet Atkins was diagnosed by her personal physicians back in Portland. Then she went to the University of Washington in Seattle for a special drug program with an experimental drug, THA, under the direct supervision of the chief investigator, who was a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
She was definitely judged to be sane. Now, I didn't judge her. The other doctors did, and the psychiatrist did. I knew her for about 2 days, and I was with her for about 10 to 12 straight hours, and I know one stretch about 8 or 9 hours straight, and I've watched her closely. I certainly could verify that her memory had gone. I could verify that her talents were gone. Now, I was with her for, say, 2 days off and on. There are many surgeons, as specialists, who have patients referred to them. They see them for a couple of hours, 1 or 2 hours in consultation, and operate. And I personally have scrubbed in on surgery in training, in which the surgeon had never seen the patient until they're in the operating room under anesthesia. Now, why don't they criticize these surgeons, too? It isn't a time period that's important in a medical specialist's competence. It's how he behaves and what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a ridiculous argument. Now, I've known two patients I'm following now for over 2 years, before Atkins, by the way. How come I didn't do them right away? Because there's a complicating factor in each case. More therapy, disease not far enough advanced, family objects, some family member objects, and until everything is settled, I won't do it. And Janet Atkins, everything was settled. She had gone through the experimental drug and gotten worse, didn't even finish the program. And I knew I was the last physician to talk to her. I knew she was going to be mentally incompetent within 4 to 6 months. And I had to do something before that point, or else I couldn't help her.
Dr. Kevorkian, you know, I think, again, some people would raise this question that if we promote rational suicide, if we have physician-assisted suicide, that somehow what that does is it gives a green light to anybody who would feel for any reason, whether they were severely depressed or they were facing very difficult life circumstances or whatever, it would somehow make suicide more acceptable, and so that we would have people, you know, not the kind of people you're talking about, but people with problems that are more, you know, that could be more dealt with by therapy or whatever, that we would have a lot more people committing suicide.
You have them now. It's increasing in teenagers and elderly, aren't they, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and that we would have even more.
I did? No. Listen, uh-huh. You people don't listen to my words. Listen closely. Because a teenager comes depressed to a doctor, comes to me, you think I'm going to help that person die? I said medically justified.
Well, I'm not suggesting that you would.
I'm saying it depends on the integrity of the doctors. And you know that many lack integrity. But so do many politicians. So do many theologians. Look at Swaggart. Look at Baker. Look at Catholic priests abusing young boys. Well, the integrity depends on the integrity of the people. Even the priesthood is under suspicion.
No,
they're doing all kinds of immoral things. It depends on the integrity. Now, you don't abolish the priesthood because there are some priests sexually abusing boys, do you? You don't abolish the priesthood. You don't abolish something because of the abuse. You try to control it. It depends on the importance and the potential of what you're trying to do.
Well, maybe I didn't ask my question clearly. I wasn't suggesting that we would have physicians assisting people to commit suicide.
Anybody can do it now anyway.
That's my point, though, that we would have more individuals making that choice and acting on their own, that we might have more people doing that if we sanction this particular kind of suicide.
Listen, they do it anyway. Did you read Time magazine in July of 89? I think it was July of 89, where they did a 1 week's toll of gunshot deaths in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? Well, I went through and picked out the ones that were for medical reasons. There were 10%, 46 out of 464. Now, they do it anyway. You got over 2,000 a year blowing their heads off with guns, only guns, not all the other means they use, because of medical problems. Now, you think that's better than having them go to having a doctor help them in their home with a device like I used? Which is better, blowing your head off and being found by a spouse, or having it done with your loved ones around you with a device? Now, that's the point. It's happening now. What's this argument about it's going to increase more? On the contrary, elderly people have called me and said, Doctor, since I know that device is there and you're there to help me, I can live comfortably for the first time in years. It dissipates the panic of the mind, and panic is what causes them to commit suicide even when they're well.
Mm.
This will reduce elderly suicide to almost zero, and I can say that from experience, but no other doctor can.
We have several callers. Our lines are all full, so I want to get back to some of these folks. We'll start with line one. Hello.
Hello. Good day, doctor. I can agree with you that that definitely sometimes medicine goes too far in trying to keep people alive when they're in a natural process of death. But one of the problems I have is that people's sense of suffering when they're in some natural process of death is in part subjective and is in part affected by the attitudes of the people around them, how supportive those people are, how supportive the general society is. One of the objections I have is that we live in a society which seems to put a lot of emphasis on youth, wellness, wholeness of body. If a person feels for some reason that perhaps they're in the midst of some disfiguring disease or aging or something like that, and they feel depressed and that they should die, but yet they are not perhaps as far as advanced along in the process of death, that death would be closer to being a natural death. How do you balance the respect between autonomy, their perception of when they should die, and some perception you have of what's medically justified death? Do you just follow what they want because of their subjective feelings, or do you believe there's some objective basis when the doctor should assist the person?
Well, I've said it about six times. It's got to be medically justified. That's objectivity. Of course not. Everyone assumes I do this at the first meeting. It takes time. I can tell very quickly when a person really wants to die. I had a brain tumor patient call me last week, went out and visited them. Lying there in bed, horribly ill, you could tell. I could sense he didn't really want to die. It's an instinct you have. I wouldn't do him now. I wouldn't. I knew he didn't really want to die. He needed just more treatment, more support or something, even though he was suffering immensely. It isn't a simple thing, but it's not that you want it and you get it. Now, understand that. It's the ultimate option. You know what ultimate means?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, you overlook other things when you say support and all that. What about a man who's on a respirator and quadriplegic, can't move from the neck down, he's been that way for 15 years, and he's 37 now, and he decides his life really isn't worth going on. Can't move anything but his head. Respirator, a tube in his throat, paralyzed from the neck down, like that David Rivlin in Michigan in 89. Doesn't matter what kind of support he has or what the loving parents are. After 17 years, don't you think he's justified in having his wish granted? You can't imagine what that kind of a mental state is.
I'm sorry, I don't agree that that necessarily would mean that he should die.
He wanted to die. I didn't say he should die. Now,
okay.
Don't you think his wish should be respected after 17 years like that? You're talking as a healthy individual. You can't imagine what it means to be that way for even 1 year, let alone 17.
You're right, I can. However, I still think that there's a subjective element here.
Well, he is. He's exercising it. He said, I want to die. That's subjective.
If this person essentially is whole in mind and could continue, he's lived for 15 years, he could continue for longer. Perhaps if his environment was better, his support...
What environment? He's got to be in a nursing home. He can't be home. Who's going to take care of him? He's in a nursing home for 17 years. You get the point? Same room, looking at the same walls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know that you're off base on this. I hate to tell you this. Your emotionalism is showing, and your opinion doesn't mean two hoots for him or me, because you can't imagine what he's going through. I sense that your imagination is very limited. I'm not trying to insult you. I'm stating a fact.
Well, should we go on to another caller?
Please, let's get on something fruitful.
I'll offer the last caller a last word. No? Okay. Let's go on to somebody else. Line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You'll like this call, I think.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I like them all. I like getting belligerent with people who talk nonsense.
I've noticed. Anyway, I'm from Michigan, and I'm proud to have this have happened in my home state. And I think it's high time that people were given a choice whether to die with dignity or to drag on and... especially in the case of Alzheimer's, like you say, in 6 months you wouldn't have been mentally competent.
Well, that's the nicest thing about it. Have you seen an Alzheimer's case?
Not long-term. I've seen some, but I haven't really had to deal with it.
You ought to see one near the end.
Time.
Yeah, you ought to see one near the end.
Why, they physically deteriorate also, you mean? Or?
Yes, they do.
Uh-huh.
They become almost immobile. Mixing feces with food and smearing it on a wall and slapping and hitting anybody that comes near them.
I did work in the mental hospitals in the early 60s before or just as psychotropic drugs were coming in, so I probably saw some then when it wasn't known what it was because I saw certainly a lot of that kind of behavior.
Let me ask you, if the Alzheimer's were diagnosed on you, would you, at this state of your life, in your stage, would you be willing to go on to the end of it?
This stage in my life, if it were diagnosed right now.
If you had a diagnosis right now, if your memory were beginning to slip and the diagnosis was probably Alzheimer's, what would you say? Would you say, well, fine, and make arrangements for your family to take care of you and everything to be, and then go on to the end without any kind of action at all, just supportive action?
Probably not, if I had the choice.
That's all Janet Atkin did was make a choice.
it's hard for me to imagine that state because of where I am right now, but...
That's why I say it's better to know, have seen a patient near the end so you can make a rational decision, see?
Right.
It's hard to imagine these things.
Well, I did want to say one other thing. My mother died last year in Beaumont Hospital. I'm sure you know the hospital.
Yes.
And she was 91. She got pneumonia, and at first she rallied. But it became apparent about the last week of pro-life. She was there 16 days, that she was going to die. And there was a young resident working on her who was still trying to pump up her potassium levels. And, you know, that's very painful to have pumped through your veins.
Yes.
And different things like that. And then the last 3 days, finally, he said he would prescribe morphine on a as-needed basis. He didn't do it. We had to wait till the next day till her own physician came from the outside. She did it. And then my sister, who was still there, who lives there, asked if she could have the morphine before she got worse because she had been really suffering terribly. And the staff said, oh, no, we couldn't do that. That would be euthanasia. And we just really threw up our hands in despair. I mean, here was somebody who was certainly going to die. She died the next day. Mm-hmm. But
she didn't suffer too long, though.
No, but that's not really the point.
That's true. It's not the point.
The point is the attitude that to make somebody comfortable would be euthanasia. They do not have a hospice unit, which is what she really needed at that point. So I'm happy that things are moving in that direction. And as for the gentleman who said you were imposing your views on everyone else, I feel that that is what he was doing to the rest of us. I do happen to consider myself a Christian, but that doesn't mean exactly what he would mean by that, I don't think.
No. And you would be the one who burns you at the stake.
Perhaps. And also, I don't see that you're imposing your views on anyone. You're offering this to someone who wants this. How is that imposing it, saying it can't, we can't have it? That's imposing someone else's views. So that's all I have to say.
Well,
thank you for being on.
All right, I thank you for the comment. Let's continue to move on. Our next caller is line number 3. Hello. Is there a caller there, line 2?
Well, maybe it's I'm not sure of my number.
Yes, go ahead.
All right, I have 2 comments. The first one will be about myself, and the next one will be about our speaker. I'm 70, and I'm a member of the Hemlock Society, which means that in general I am in favor of assisted dying for those that wish it and are in a condition in which they don't want to remain. My chief fear is Alzheimer's, and for one thing, I don't want to be, for economic reasons, I don't want to be lying in a helpless state for years, using up my own estate or going on Medicaid. I want to live as long as I can, if I'm not in great pain, as long as I have my senses and my reason, and my body will function with only such help as I can afford. Now, having said that, I want to say something else, and I'll hang up immediately afterwards because I don't want to get into an argument with the speaker.
Mm-hmm.
I think the speaker is a very poor advocate for the cause of assisted death. He's much too argumentative. He doesn't listen to what other people are saying. He just plows in, and he doesn't take the trouble to follow other people's reasoning. I'm sorry that we don't have a better advocate for a cause that I really believe in. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dr. Gvorkian, you...
Well, Hemlock has never been for me. Humphrey has always obstructed what I'm trying to do because he thinks I'm too radical. You know, the goodness of planned death, we only touch the surface. It isn't that you help someone who's suffering die. That's part of it. That's a minimal goodness. The real goodness is extracting benefit back from death, like taking organs for transplantation. Janet Atkins wanted to donate organs. Society wouldn't allow it, and doctors wouldn't take them. And then condemn criminals' organs and AIDS patients who want to be experimented on under anesthesia from which they don't wake up. This is the goodness. Organs can save 5 or 6 or 7 people, but an experiment may save millions. And that's why Humphrey's against me and Hemlock's against me. Now, they say they want a better advocate. Well, they have doctors in Hemlock. Why don't the philosophic cowards speak out? You ever hear a doctor in Hemlock speak out? Hemlock is political. I am not a politician. I'm doing what a doctor should do. And if Hemlock were really sincere, they would have endorsed me 100% because what they're doing in Washington isn't enough. Atkins or Rivlin would never have qualified for that project because they got to be terminal within 6 months. That can help a few cancer patients, and that's all. And they suffer for just weeks and months maybe. But others who are crippled and paralyzed And with Alzheimer's, they suffer for years. And I found out from experience, these are the people that want my service, not cancer patients. Hemlock is somewhat meretricious. If she wants a better advocate, talk to your doctors in Hemlock, these cowards who are afraid to speak out.
That's
Don't talk to me. I am not a coward, and I'm not a politician. I know what I'm doing is right. I'm a doctor. Therefore, Hemlock is irrelevant. You're lay people. When this is established medically, Hemlock is irrelevant. I'm doing it the right way. I was there. I had an open, honest approach. I had a cardiogram running. I used the quickest way possible. What's wrong with it? Because I speak stridently? Well, I have to. I'm alone. Even Hemlock doesn't support.
I need to jump in because we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I just wonder if I could ask you, Dr. Kevorkian, you know, because of these very strong views that you hold and the strength with which you have expressed them, you've really made yourself an outsider. And it seems that you could have lived a very different life if you hadn't been on such a strong cause. And I wonder, why?
Anybody could live a different life if you chose. All you have to assume is that you're living a life that was built into you genetically. Who knows? What can you say? It's a philosophic point. Anybody, you could have done a different life. You could have gone to college, taken another course. You know, you could have gone and lived in India for a while, and that would have given you a different course. Anyone can choose to change his life. All you can say is that's what you were. You got to be fatalistic.
So you feel that you couldn't have taken any other course than the one that you took?
Well, of course you could. I'm saying anybody could. But all you've got to, you must assume that you took the one that you cut out for. What else can you say? It doesn't really matter. What you say about it doesn't matter. This is what happened. Mm.
That is Jack Kevorkian. He was a guest on our show, Focus 580, September 1991. In the late 90s, he was tried four times for assisting in suicides. In 1999, he was charged with murder for euthanizing a man in the final stages of Lou Gehrig's disease. He was found guilty, sent to prison. He served a little over 8 years. He was paroled in 2007. He continued to be an advocate for assisted suicide. He died in June of this year. He was 83. This year, our program turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we're digging into our tape collection, looking for interesting people with things to say about important subjects. We're calling it the Deep Archives, and we'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the Air Force's Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performs a couple of songs in tribute to the men and women who have served since 9/11. And NBC News chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel tells behind-the-scenes stories about his recent reporting from Libya, Egypt, and Afghanistan. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign. For over 25 years, 10,000 Villages has provided income to artisans in more than 30 developing countries by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Most doctors would not have done what Jack Kevorkian did, inviting prosecution by admitting they had helped a patient to die. Back in 1993, we talked with one doctor who did. He risked prison and loss of his license in order to get his fellow doctors and the public talking about the issue. That doctor was Timothy Quill. He had a patient with a severe form of leukemia. Treatment would be painful, the long-term success only 20%. So she made the decision to decline treatment and to die at home. Several months after the diagnosis, she took an overdose of barbiturates that had been prescribed by Dr. Quill. Only the doctor, the patient's family, would have known had not the doctor taken the highly unusual step of writing about the case for the New England Journal of Medicine. Timothy Quill was a guest on our show in March of 1993. I asked what led him to take this risk of going public about his role in the death of his patient.
Well, I think the discussion at that time about this particular issue was extraordinarily abstract, that people were arguing about it from the ivory tower, and it wasn't really reflecting, I think, the true struggles that doctors and patients go through on occasion when people are really suffering terrible and they have no exit, no end other than death. And it was my opinion that the few cases that actually were in the medical literature were very easy to take apart and dissect and dismiss with. And it was as if the whole topic was not worthy of discussion. Against this background, I had known many patients who really had struggled terribly at the end and had not found the medical system very responsive to them. So I felt I had had this experience, and it would be a useful experience to put out there for people to discuss, think about, feel about. In point of fact, the article I wrote, I feel, was much more about letting an individual find their own path and allowing that to happen at the end of life than truly assisted suicide, even though technically it involved assisting suicide.
Hmm. Well, perhaps we ought to talk a little bit more about the particular case and about your relationship to this woman, because people certainly should understand that this was someone who you had known and had been a patient of yours for a number of years. It was not someone that you who had walked in off the street, and it was someone that you felt that you knew well. You knew the woman's family. You certainly knew all of the dimensions of her condition and her case, and it was someone that you had a long-standing, well, relatively speaking, I guess, long-standing relationship with.
Sure. I had known this particular person for 8 years prior to the time that she got very sick. We had been through several other major illnesses together, and this certainly was the largest challenge that she had ever faced, although she had really faced some other very difficult challenges in her life. But I knew her very well, and she knew me well to some degree by our work together. I want to emphasize that her decision, you outlined the case initially in your presentation, her decision not to undertake the treatment for acute leukemia, the right of any person not to take any treatment that they don't want to take is really a settled issue legally and ethically. So even though there was some controversy around that, I think from an ethical and legal point of view, that is a settled issue, that any person can not undertake any treatment that they don't want to, provided they're competent and they're fully informed.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I think that's where we started exploring some new ground, that new ground being she was someone who was very afraid of what if at the end, my suffering became intolerable to me, what if it became overwhelming that I had only death to look forward to. Would you be willing to work with me to find a way out if that would happen? And I feel that's a commitment that we must make to all of our patients, that we will really still work with them if they are unfortunate enough to end up in such a state.
Mm-hmm. Well, in what way did you discuss what it was that she intended to do, and how open was the discussion between the two of you about her wanting to have this option?
Well, when she first decided not to undergo the treatment for acute leukemia, we then had to address the question, well, what do we do now if we're not going to do that? Mm-hmm. We still have to work together for the time that's left. And basically what I recommended to her at that time was a form of hospice care, comfort care, which is a pretty standard approach to a person who has a short lifespan. It's actually a wonderful form of care. It's a very humane alternative to the kind of high-tech death that many people are fearful of. You know, emphasizes symptom management, pain control, contact with family, support, those kinds of things, spiritual exploration. So I have a great faith in this kind of care, and I did offer that to her, and she was very appreciative of that, but she had fears about what if at some point in this that things get way out of control, even with comfort care, would I have some options? So it was she that raised the possibility, not I.
Mm-hmm.
And in the discussion, it was a very, I believe this discussion is too important to be between the lines, to be something that's a subtle conversation. I think it really needs to be explored directly and forthrightly, because it's a very delicate discussion, and you really want to be sure that someone knows what they're getting into.
I suppose one of the things that I wonder about is when it came to the point where you wrote the prescription for the pills that she used, and if I'm misrepresenting anything, you know, any of this, do correct me. I just wonder what was going through your mind at the time, because I'm sure that you knew what her intention was, and I wonder how it is you wrestled with whether or not you yourself would take that step to essentially provide the means.
Well, I certainly wrestled with it at a number of different levels. I think from the point that she had the prescription to the point that she took her life, there was a three-month period. During that time, she was on a hospice program. So that, I think the initial prescription for her was gave her a sense of security that there would be an out if she found herself in that kind of a state. Now, part of that prescription was an agreement, a contract between her and me, that before she would ever use it, that we would meet face-to-face, talk things over, be sure all other possible alternatives had been exhausted. And in point of fact, she, during that three-month period between the prescription and the time she took her life, really underwent several kinds of life-prolonging treatments, took some antibiotics for infections, was transfused several times, really lived a very full life during that time.
Do you, I wonder, have any feeling or idea, or maybe there is someone who does, of how many doctors may have done what you did, and we never heard anything about it?
Well, there's been some research about this. It's very it's methodologically difficult, because to admit that you've done something like this puts you in some legal vulnerability. So it's very difficult to get reliable statistics about it. But the statistics that are out there suggest that anywhere from probably 10 to 40% of doctors have participated. I think when doctors have been surveyed about whether they feel doctors should be able to be more actively involved in this, I think over half believe that they should be able to be more involved, or feel that doctors should be able to be more involved, although only about half of those felt that they would be able to be more involved themselves. So there's some difference of opinion about this, but doctors break out on this issue much like the general public. Hmm. I think the statistics are quite fair.
You said that you felt that this was not truly, you didn't think of this truly as physician-assisted suicide, and I wonder how one makes that distinction.
Well, I would say technically it is physician-assisted suicide, but I think that what's important about this kind of decision-making is it's really being led by a competent patient who knows what she wants, has explored all other alternatives, is really at the time that she takes this suffering in a way that for her was excruciating. And I think if you follow the depth of the discussion going through, it's really a very patient-driven process by a person who does not have any good options. These are not people who particularly want to die. If there were any way they could live or not die, and live in a way that they would have meaning for them, they would choose life. Mm-hmm. So it's really sort of the last resort option that these folks are asking about. And they're asking really not to be abandoned at the last resort. I also want to emphasize that hospice care really, I think, provides answers almost all the time. So these are relatively exceptional cases.
Mm. Well, that's something that I did indeed want to ask you about, because I wonder if we do have good hospice care and it is possible for people to die at home if that is their wish, if we make it possible for them to be as comfortable as we can to reduce their pain and anxiety and make them as comfortable as possible, why is it then we still need to have this option? Why can't good hospice or good comfort care suffice?
Well, I think it does suffice, and the statistics on this are somewhat variable. I think most experienced people believe that it works to provide adequate symptom management and control all the way through about 95% of the time, and we could quibble about whether it's 1% or 5% or 10% or more. But the need to discuss this issue, it has to do with that 1 or 5 or 10% of patients for whom hospice care either doesn't work or stops working. And they then find themselves in an excruciating situation with no exit, that all they have to look forward to is death, and that's not coming very quickly or easily. And I think those are often the toughest cases. They may not be common, but they are really extraordinary, and they have an extraordinary effect on both the patient and the people who care about them. One of the amazing things that happened as a result of writing this story in the New England Journal is that so many people came up to me and told me their personal stories about a family member, someone they loved or cared about, who in essence experienced humiliation or disintegration prior to dying. Well, those kinds of experiences really stay with you for a lifetime. They are unforgettable, and I think if we have people that we are trying to treat humanely at the end of life, we cannot allow those kinds of states to persist if there's something we can do about them.
Something that you address in the book, and I'm sure that you were asked, is about the oath that doctors take that requires them to do no harm to patients, and emphasizes what historically has been the mission that physicians have taken on, and that is to, in whatever way possible, to promote health and prolong life. And some people have said that that for a physician to assist a patient to die is contrary to that oath that physicians take when they begin their practice. And I wonder how it is you think about that and this this particular language about doing no harm and prolonging life.
Well, I think the language is challenging, and there are some directives that sometimes find themselves in contradiction within the oath. We are supposed to prolong life, and in point of fact, we've probably trained our young physicians over the last 20 years almost exclusively to prolong life, and that's one of the things that drives so many high technology deaths. You know, elderly people who are dying in intensive care units with tubes in every orifice, that kind of stuff, which are images that are frightening to all of us, I think. To balance that out, we talk about our need to eliminate human suffering as best we can. And I think when a person is dying, the balance of that oath becomes paramount to relieve and address human suffering, much more so than prolonging life. Many times if another person with a potentially reversible illness may have to go through a great deal of suffering to potentially recover and prolong their life, and we ask them to do that. And they are often very willing to, because they can then return to a full and meaningful life, or a life that they can find meaning in. But when a person is dying, we ask a different trade-off. Sometimes we'll even give things, and it's standard practice, to give things that might inadvertently shorten life in the interest of relieving their suffering. So we are now able to give pain medicines in much larger doses than we used to do, so that a person doesn't have to fear dying in pain. So we make trade-offs all the time, and we have to do that. That's just the nature of the business. People are making life and death decisions in hospitals on a daily basis and making trade-offs.
One of the things that I imagine would be difficult for physicians, particularly if they were not trained in psychology, would be to evaluate a patient's psychological condition. And in fact, I think some people would argue that the desire for suicide is a sign of psychological distress, and that in fact, if that is treated, whether it's a result of stress or depression or whatever it is, if you treat that, then there are many people who change their mind about this, about wanting to have that option. And I wonder what you think about that.
I look at it, it can be at times very difficult to determine whether depression is coloring a person's desire to die. And I think when there is a question of any significance about that, you need to get an expert, experienced psychiatrist to be involved with you to help make that assessment, because it's very fundamental. People who are that sick and dying are not happy. They are sad, and many are depressed. On the other side of the coin, however, it is naive to think that somebody who is disintegrating, who is in excruciating suffering situation, to think that a psychiatrist or an antidepressant medication is going to come in and miraculously make that situation okay is just plain, it's nothing. It's not helpful at all. So there are people whose suffering and whose desire anybody would understand, who would be able to tolerate spending 5 minutes or 15 minutes with them. Then there's another group of patients who are very fearful about the future, about what suffering might be like. I think they're much more difficult to assess, and we need to have psychiatrists involved in helping us make those assessments. But those people have more time. They're not right at death's door. It's very hard to get a psychiatrist to go to death's door and be with people. They're not used to that. They're not particularly in making those kinds of assessments as well.
Well, I suppose that there, right there, is the crux of the whole matter, that no physician is really trained to go with people to death's door.
That's probably some of the problem that we've had. Even though physicians are with them at death's door, they're just not talking with them. They're not learning with them. They're not continuing to follow their lead. They are more, the tradition, I guess, would be more of a withdrawal at that time. And or a pretending like death isn't right at the door. And I think that's the challenge that we have, and why I'm pushing so hard to have doctors and patients stay engaged in this process and explore what it might be like.
You know, I think that the reaction, people's reaction to this kind of conversation shows that people are very sensitive to the idea of this loss of control. That they think about, you know, they imagine themselves having a terminal illness, and they think about the cost, possible pain or prolonged treatment that might end up extending their life by months. They think about the burden on their families. They like the idea of making that quality of life decision themselves, and when they choose, having a peaceful death. And I think all one has to do is look at the success of Derek Humphreys, his organization, the Hemlock Society, and in particular the book, Last Exit, which came out last year, I believe it was last year, and was a bestseller. And so obviously there are people who are interested in the topic and in seeking the means to have control. My impression is that your feeling is that the success of Hemlock, the success of that book, is a sign that you and your colleagues in the medical profession ultimately have failed.
I think it's that people don't have a great deal of faith that we'll continue to work with them no matter what happens. My guess is what happened with Final Exit is that very few people read it. But they put it up on their shelf just in case, because the information in it might be valuable to them. It's not a great book. It advises lying to your doctor in order to get the proper medication so you could eventually take your life, mm-hmm. as opposed to deeply engaging with your doctor to make sure the doctor will continue to work with you. I think people are very afraid of this, that whatever their view is of the end of life where they would be suffering terribly. And that varies person to person. I've talked to many people about that, and many of the stories in my book are of people's view of what that might be like. And what they need is somebody who will say, okay, if you get there, I'll continue to work with you to find a way out, either to control the symptoms better or to find a way just so you don't have to live there. And I think that's what people are really crying for. Now, I want to also emphasize that if they have a doctor or can find someone who knows how to use comfort care or hospice care, most of the time they will not need that, the out of assisted suicide. The palliative care works most of the time. But on the other hand, that security is there if you have somebody who will work with you. I think when you get back to the original case I wrote about, Diane lived for 3 months without having to worry that if she got into that state, she would be forced to stay there. She had that freedom. I firmly believe she would have taken her life sooner had she not had that security.
We're at the point where we only have maybe about a minute left. Is there some way to develop a public policy dealing with this, some sort of framework for where this discussion between patient and doctor can take place?
Well, we've tried to put forward some guidelines for this. Again, these are in the book, but basically it is restricted to competent patients. It only makes sense in the context of hospice care or comfort care and when that kind of care has been found wanting. It only makes sense when you've excluded depression, when a person is rational. And we want it to be a much more open process whereby an external person will come in and look at the patient, look at the data to make sure all the criteria have been met. I think it is possible to define very conservative criteria and then see if it helps. Again, I think most people would be more reassured about the possibility than the reality. They would find that security that option is there, but they would never act on it. But they would know also that we would not abandon them if they get into that horrible state. Diane, the woman I wrote about, died alone. She died alone because she was fearful if anybody was with her, they could be subject to prosecution, and she was probably right. And I think we should be very troubled by that.
On our program, Dr. Timothy Quill. He was a guest on our program, Focus 580, in March of 1993. He's the author of the book, Death and Dignity, Making Choices and Taking Charge. Today, Dr. Quill is professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. This year, our program turned 30, and we're celebrating that fact by digging into our tape collection, looking for interesting people with important things to say on important subjects. They're programs that are not part of our web archive. Most of them aren't, and in most cases, they've not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project, and you can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you'll find a place to leave a comment. You may also write to us at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801.
They would find that security that option is there, but they would never act on it. But they would know also that we would not abandon them if they get into that horrible state. Diane, the woman I wrote about, died alone. She died alone because she was fearful if anybody was with her, they could be subject to prosecution, and she was probably right. And I think we should be very troubled by that.
On our program, Dr. Timothy Quill. He was a guest on our program, Focus 580, in March of 1993. He's the author of the book, Death and Dignity, Making Choices and Taking Charge. Today, Dr. Quill is professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. This year, our program turned 30, and we're celebrating that fact by digging into our tape collection, looking for interesting people with important things to say on important subjects. They're programs that are not part of our web archive. Most of them aren't, and in most cases, they've not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project, and you can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you'll find a place to leave a comment. You may also write to us at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801.
Today's programs are made possible by Champagne Cycle, 506 South Country Fair Drive in Champaign. With gas prices going higher, more people are looking at the bicycle as serious transportation to work or the store. Trek Ride Plus bicycles offer an electric boost to the rider's natural pedaling, allowing them to go farther with less effort.
And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. 1 minute before noon, 63 degrees in Urbana.
In Kansas City, September wheat turning at 814.5, down 9.5. December, 837.75, down 8.25. September wheat in Chicago, down 7.5 at 701.75. The December contract, 731, down 7. September corn, 724.75, up 1.5. December, 735.5, up 1.5. March, 748.5, up 1.75, and the May contract up 0.5 at 754.5. September soybeans, 14.07 1/4 unchanged. November, 14.21, up 2.75. January, 14.31, up 2.5. March, 14.36.5, up 1.75. September soybean meal, 367.20, that's up 170. September soybean oil, 57.72, down 10. October live cattle, 118.95, up 12.5. December, 118.60, down 45. September feeder cattle, 134.20, up 25. October, 135.55, down 10. October lean hogs, 86.90, that's up 10 cents. October crude, 86.03, down 302. The U.S. dollar, 77.20.